This week on Art of the Air returns local jazz legend Billy Foster discussing his upcoming Zoom class about Duke Ellington, available through IUN Senior University. Next, we have Chesterton Art Center's new program director, Jillian Bridgman, discussing her own art journey and classes at the Art Center. Our spotlight is on Valparaiso Kiwanis Club hosting the Purdue Men's Varsity Glee Club on February 6th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. Just heard was the Purdue Varsity Men's Glee Club, and they are going to be coming to Northwest Indiana soon. Welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight, and they're being presented by Concerts Kiwanis, and they've had them here every year or every other year, I think, since 2007. And we have the chair of the Kiwanis Committee responsible for producing the concert coming Sunday, February 6th at Valparaiso High School, Roger Lukens. Welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on this program.
Yeah, welcome.
Well, tell us a little bit about the history of Concerts Kiwanis having Purdue Men's Glee Club come there.
This has been a unique, different fundraising opportunity for Kiwanis for all these years. Back in 2007, ironically, there was only a committee of four, and two of them were Rotarians. Barb Smith was a Rotarian, and her grandson was singing in the Glee Club that year. And Rotary didn't want to sponsor it that year, and she came to us. And so Bob Westfall from Kiwanis and myself said, well, why don't we do this? And Barb and then Chuck Warden from the Rotary said, we'll help you. And the four of us produced the first concert, and we made over $10,000 that year. So that turned out to be a good thing for us. And of course, Kiwanis uses the profits to put right back into the community. Since that time, we have held the concert at Valparaiso Auditorium, except for the one year when they were redoing their auditorium, and we held the concert in Chesterton at their lovely auditorium. But so this will be our eighth concert since 2007. We were supposed to have this concert in 2021, but that did not happen because of COVID.
So what are some of the things that your Kiwanis in Valparaiso support and do? I know in the old days it was like selling peanuts because my dad was a part of Woodmark Kiwanis years ago. But what are some of the activities that you use your funds for?
Well, really, we have try to support. We try to focus on kids and focus on families and support them. I asked for a list from our treasurer of the things that we have donated to this past year, and he gave me a list of 126 different things, and it ranges from supporting our leadership clubs in schools, our key clubs at the high schools. Five high schools, really, Valpo, Wheeler, Boone Grove, Washington Township, and Morgan Township. We have builders clubs in most of those schools, too. Builders clubs are for middle school students. We do support two Circle K clubs, which are for universities, Purdue University Northwest and Valparaiso University. And there's one additional club which is very special to us because it's for special people. It's over at Opportunity Enterprises, and it's for adults in the Action Club. And the Action Club is spelled with a K, obviously, for Kiwanis. We're proud of those groups, and we promote leadership for those groups.
So, Roger, how do people, can they get advance tickets?
They certainly can. We have tickets available through any branch, Valparaiso branch of First Source Bank. There's also posters around town that has a QR code, which you can scan into your phone and get the tickets that way. You can get them through any Kiwanis member, of course, but all of these places, we try to sell all 964 seats in the auditorium. We've done that several times.
Well, and if they do it in advance, they get a $5 discount. Is that correct? If they purchase them ahead of time, it's $15 as opposed to $20 at the door?
Yes, it's $20 at the door, but adults are $15. And children, and we should say school-age children, are $10, and children under five are free. We also make exception for groups in elder care facilities, and we provide them with a $10 ticket help them. So, yes, it's much to the advantage of $20 at the door, and if it's sold out, you'll be out of luck if you come on the day of the concert.
Well, we'd like to thank you for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight. Roger Lukens, who's the chair of the Concerts Kiwanis Purdue Varsity Glee Club, coming Sunday, February 6th to Valparaiso High School. And thank you so much for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight and sharing about Purdue Glee Club.
Thank you so much.
Listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Thank you.
you're hearing there is the Duke Ellington Take the A Train, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that with our guest today, someone who's no stranger to Art on the Air. In fact, every time you listen to our show, you hear music from Billy Foster, so we'd like to welcome him to talk about that and his senior university class at IU Northwest. Billy, welcome back to Art on the Air.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Esther, and I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
I have to also say that Billy's wife, Renee Miles Foster, is doing the vocals on his composition. So it's a lot of family love there.
Yes.
And we really appreciate that. That was so nice to have our own theme song. And it's heard both every week at the beginning and end of our show. And so it's we're real thankful for that, having a Billy Foster original with us. So, well, anyway, what we're here to talk about today is you're involved with IU Northwest, and you do a thing that's part of their whole outreach program. It's in their
Center for Urban and Regional Excellence.
And they call it the Senior University. And it's, well, it's supposed to be targeted for ages 55 and better. But I think it actually would. But what they call is they have these classes that you can take. Some of them are Zoom and everything. But we're going to focus on your classes, which I have to say I took the last one you had. And we'll talk a little bit about that in the upcoming one. And we'll tell a little bit about that. So first of all, just tell us about Senior University a little bit. And then we'll first focus on the last class you talked about was Miles Davis. And it was actually a two-session class. So tell us a little bit about Senior University and how you're involved in it.
Well, the way that I'm involved in it is that I'm teaching jazz classes right now over Zoom, but originally those classes were in person. But because of the pandemic, we've gone to Zoom, which strangely enough opens the in-person classes had limitations as far as the numbers of people you could have in the class. But now that we're doing the Zoom classes, the one advantage to it is that you can have as many people as you want. It doesn't affect anything. And
they're from all over the world.
Don't tell anybody this, but I've invited people that are under 55. So
that's
So the thing is, though, is that you have to register for the class. And you can do that in a couple of different ways. You can do it online, and you can do it by this telephone number, which I'll wait so everybody can get a pencil to write down the telephone number for registration. I'll say it right now, though. It's 219-980-6907. And I'll do the number again later on, 219-980-6907. Well, I can't say how many times I've forgotten to put in the 219 these days.
But. Yeah, you have to do that nowadays, otherwise it won't.
So make sure you put that in.
And it's a very friendly, I've called it many times, it's a very, very friendly staff. They always get back to you, so... it's a great organization.
And real quick, actually, if you're computer literate, you just go online. You go there to you just go to iu.edu, iun.edu, and search for the Senior University, and you can just click on a button there that says register, and that's how I do it because I like doing the computer stuff instead of calling. And boom, you can do it right away, and you're in like Flint. So
well, that's great. This particular class that we're doing this time is on Duke Ellington, and it takes place on January 24th and the 27th from 6:30 to 8 o'clock. You can also attend the class by phone, so you don't have to be on Zoom necessarily. If you don't have Zoom or not familiar with it, you can do the class by phone.
Well, the classes are always exciting. I think this will be the fourth or fifth series I've taken with you, Billy. And every single time you always introduce new music or musicians I didn't know about, especially pieces of music that I hadn't heard before. So the class is so delightful, not only with all your inside stories and and you have wonderful guests who also are part of the audience who are very well versed in jazz. So it's a lively conversation as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like a who's who of jazz, local jazz people that are in there that have great discussions and everything. Well, your last class was Miles Davis, and I attended that one. And tell us a little bit, you know, how you approach the class, and maybe use that as an example before we move on to the Duke Ellington and what we can kind of expect from that. But like you sign up for a class, what can someone expect from it? How does that work? I know it's a combination of lectures, but tell us about your format for the class.
Well, the format
and how you choose your artist.
Okay, the format for the class is that I try to get as many videos as I can to play of the artist, and I might want to play something where I can't find a video, so I'll just use the audio, like a record of the artist playing something that I want the audience to hear. And that's basically how I do it, and I try to give as much information about the artist as I can, especially musically, and how the artist's music is changing through the years. I try to do it chronologically if I can. I'll start way back when the artist first started and move up to the present day, and we'll talk about what the artist was doing in any certain years during that time. So that's basically what I try to do with if I'm doing it about an artist. Now, I also did, I've done classes on the big bands and some of the small bands in jazz, and the saxophone and the trumpet and some other subjects we've used where we aren't talking about a specific artist, but a number of artists maybe. Like the one that we did on the saxophone, of course, we would start with somebody like Johnny Hodges or Coleman Hawkins, people who were in the beginnings of using the saxophone in jazz. And so with that one, you'd have several artists, and I was trying to demonstrate the development of the instrument in jazz. So and the same thing with the big bands. We still... some people think we don't have big bands, but we still have big bands, actually. And the fastest way to find a big band is in your local high school.
That's true. That is very true.
So, Billy, have you ever done the women in jazz? Like, focus just on
the... You know what? I did that on the radio more than once, but I have not done it with this series. And you know what? I was going to do something next, but I think that would be more important to do. So you just selected the next topic.
Wonderful. Well, I remember in the big band series, you had the it was a group of women, all big band. They had their own big band, and it was just so wonderful and interesting, especially that you had video on it as well.
Yeah, that was part of the development of the big bands, because during the war years, a lot of the guys went off to fight, and that left the women to organize jazz bands. And there were some, as you saw, some very good ones.
Very.
I'm waiting for the Maynard Ferguson one at some time.
Oh, did you? I might be wrong about this, but when you were teaching, didn't you guys have Maynard at your high school?
They had him at Highland, and that was after I left Highland. In fact, my daughter got to play. You know, because he always did those side-by-side things where they had the local jazz band play. So she actually, and I didn't get to see it because I had an event. This one was at Center of Visual Performing Arts. I had an event that night, so I couldn't go. I've met Maynard several times. The first time I saw him was at Ratso's in, Lincoln Street in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, sure,
And then several other times at other things. I think I saw him also when he was at Hobart High School, because he did a lot of those clinic-type things in later years. So, yeah, but,
We had him at Valparaiso University, and I got a chance to take him to dinner and hang out with him some. He's a very nice person. He was.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah. He has a great story to tell about how his music was reformed when he, like a lot of jazz musicians of that era, got involved with drugs, went to India, got himself cleaned up, and brought back an Indian influence in his 1970s music for a while, in the MF's Horn albums. There was a lot of Indian influence in there.
Yeah, strangely enough, just last night on the news, I was watching a little segment on Ravi Shankar, and they named several jazz musicians that he had an influence on.
Right.
And I suspect Maynard probably was one of those.
You know, I remember, and a friend of mine, I didn't really subscribe to Playboy, but he had they had that best jazz artist, like once a year they did a thing, you know, at Playboy magazine, and he always got rated as a trombonist in their ideal band, and I was always a little surprised at that, though he did like to use valve trombone, but yeah. But anyway, for our audience, this is kind of the discussion you'll hear on different musicians. I know when Billy had Miles Davis, he kind of took us through the evolution of that music. Tell us a little bit about that. We don't want to stay too long on it, but you know how his music started and evolved over the years, and that's kind of the journey you took us on in those two classes.
Yeah, let me just say this. Maynard was responsible for an instrument being, I don't remember the company, but it was a valve slide trombone.
Right.
So, what was that?
His whole line of those were called MF horns.
It had a name.
They call them MF horns. Superbone. Superbone is what it was called.
Superbone. That was what that was. It had a slide and valve.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing he could do that and play trumpet too, because the mouthpieces are so different.
Yeah, the embouchure is so different. Yeah, it's
right.
And of course, the big thing that marked Maynard Ferguson is that his how he hits the stratospheric notes that other can't and hit them cleanly. I mean, it's like he kind of invented that whole really high end ability to hit the horn music.
Yeah, that was his thing. but he also had several good bands.
Yes, he did, and yeah. he's another one that started out very young. So with his bands.
Yeah, Maynard Ferguson is from Canada. And he and Oscar Peterson went to high school together.
Oh, no. See, I didn't know that. So, wow.
Yeah.
See, and that's just a little bit of the tidbits you get in these classes, just all these really interesting stories and trivia, really, that you know.
The one of the fun parts about it that you mentioned was, like, some of my friends are internationally known musicians. And some of them tune in sometimes, and so we can have some really good discussions with them and some of the things that they've done.
Yeah, that it's like so.
Which is what happened on this last class.
Yeah, it's so precious.
We even have disagreements.
Yes, I know. It's a real live conversation. It's wonderful.
Well, yeah, the Miles Davis thing was very interesting because he's such a, and of course what's interesting is also. Hearing your discussion goes hand in hand with the PBS documentary about his life and times, and that's very interesting. So, well, what can we look forward to with Duke Ellington, everything, without talking about the specifics, but, you know, you have two charts there, and my gosh, he's composed most of his songs are part not only of the jazz songbook, but the overall American songbook. It's been covered by, you know, countless musicians.
Right.
Well, so yeah, when did Duke Ellington in your time? When did you become aware of him? I mean,
maybe about 5 years after I was born.
Okay.
Not only did my parents have some Duke Ellington records in my house when I was about five, my parents bought me a record player, and so they bought me like a album set of Nat King Cole's that had. Records on that were geared toward people my age at the time. So I had that set of records. And then they bought me a set of records that had stuff like people singing the ABCs and,
oh,
you know, those kinds of things. But after a minute, I noticed they had much better records than I had. They had Duke Ellington and Count Basie records. So I didn't really stick to my records. I dove into the Duke Ellington collection, and that's when I became aware of that music. Plus, my parents, after that, I must have been seven maybe not even that old. They took me to the Regal Theater in Chicago. And I got to see Count Basie and Duke Ellington and Sarah Vaughan and those people in those stage shows. So I became aware of those people early on in my life.
So how did you chose Duke Ellington for your next class? So tell us a little more about some of the things that, without giving away the whole class, we can expect about the evolution of Duke Ellington and things like that. Just a little bit of background.
So Duke Ellington was one of the most important jazz musicians ever. And he was born in 1899. And his career stretched all the way till 1974 when he died. He was still a performing musician at that time. And he's a person that wrote thousands of compositions. And so, obviously, we won't be able to get to all of his compositions. But we're going to try to hit the ones that are highlights during his career, and we won't get to all of those. But that's what I intend to do with Duke Ellington. He was quite an unusual person in that he led a band. He composed all this music, and the band was playing more than 300 dates a year.
Wow.
So unlike most composers who get to compose sitting at the piano at their house, Duke Ellington was doing all these things on the road, on trains and in cars. And it's just really amazing because Duke Ellington was the pianist in his band. These are all full-time jobs. He was a pianist in his band. He conducted business for his band. He led the band. And he was a composer. It's just unheard of, really.
Yeah, he was very good at balancing everything, not only composing, but allowing for that improvised moments that jazz brings. I mean, he had such a gift of melody and texture, you know, like it's...
Right. So Duke Ellington was a genius, is the short of it.
Do you know the story? You know the story probably of how he got the nickname Duke. Yeah, of course, that he wasn't born with that. You know, his name was Edward Kennedy Ellington. But what's that?
Yeah, well, there are lots of stories, but most people settle on his when he was growing up. He dressed, of course, very stylishly, and his friends started calling him Duke. And this was early in his life.
And that he had kind of high end mannerisms. Weren't both of his parents pianists also?
Yeah, I guess they were. They were, see, his father at one point worked as a butler in the White House.
Right.
Yeah. And his mother, see, I don't remember what it was she did. I'm not sure that she did anything for a living. It was a middle class family from Washington, D.C. And Duke had a sister, and they both were treated very well. Duke Ellington had an original talent as a painter. He had a scholarship to Pratt Institute that he turned down. One of the other things he was doing as a teenager was booking bands. He wouldn't only book his own band, but he had other bands he was booking. So he was making money doing that. And so he turned down the art opportunity.
and pursued another art opportunity. So, in the format of the two classes, you actually mix a discussion along with a history and kind of an evolution of their music. So that's what someone could expect on Zoom. And of course, it's interactive. You can ask questions. Is that the kind
of anybody's welcome to ask a question. Whether I can answer it or not is another story, but maybe somebody else in the group can answer it. You know, and there may be people in the group aside from me that have actually seen Duke Ellington. I had the opportunity to see him several times, so I'm happy about that.
So Esther has inspired you to do Women in Jazz as your next class. What's Lisa, what are some ideas beyond that?
Well, strangely enough, right now there seem to be more women involved in jazz than ever. And some really good musicians. There's an all-women's big band called Diva, and they're really good. We'll certainly pull out something by Diva. In the 40s, there were the International Sweethearts of Jazz, which was a real probably the most popular women's band back then. So we'll just start back and dig up and see who we can find. But there are women, there have always been women singers in jazz, but now we have a lot of women who are playing instruments. Terry Lynn Carrington was a really well-known drummer in jazz, and she played one of her first gigs with Clark Terry, the trumpet player, when she was 10. So she's an exceptional, one of the more exceptional ones. But there's several women in jazz that we won't have any trouble filling up the time with this stuff.
And the other thing is your Jazz Zone, you're no longer in the broadcast part of that because of the changes at the station, but are you podcasting any new material or can you listen to past episodes anywhere?
Not right now. I'm going to work on that and see what we can do as far as getting the show back up and running.
I know. I miss it.
Yeah, it's important for us to keep jazz in its proper place in the musical heritage that we have. Well, we just have about a few moments left here. Billy, tell us a little bit about how they can get involved with Senior University and your upcoming class, which is coming up very soon.
Okay, I'd like to read this registration number once again. If you want to be in attendance on Zoom or on the phone on the class that we're doing on Duke Ellington on January 24th and 27th, you need to register at this number, 219-980-6907. That would be with IUN and the Senior University class. Let me read that number once again. It's 219-980-6907.
Or you can go online at senioruniversity.iun.edu, and you must register by noon on January 21st. Classes start January 24th at 6:30, and the second class for that one is Thursday, January 27th, called The Musical History of Duke Ellington. Our guest today is Billy Foster, someone who is very familiar with us on the show. Thank you for coming on Art in the Air and talking about your class, Billy.
The fabulous Billy Foster. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. So much fun.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And now we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air. She's got a long history, actually, in art. She studied. She's from Lansing, Illinois, originally, now resides in Crown Point. Just left Andrean High School to take on a new position. Studied at DePaul University with art media design concentration, graduating in 2019, and has a great experience in different times of teaching. But now she's taking on a new project here at the Chesterton Art Center. Please welcome to Art in the Air, Jillian Bridgman. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, so when you say a long art career, I'm going to ask this both to Larry and Jillian. So with graduating in just 2019, that puts you at a very young age. So are you considering from the time you were like in elementary school? Is that what you were referring to, Larry, a long art career?
Well, I'm sure she's been in art, but I'm sure, Jillian, you can tell us about a long art career.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, speaking on that, I have definitely been the art nerd since a very young age, all the way down to a little tiny tot. I always was creating art. But on the professional side of it, I kind of looked out and started my career, I would say, fairly young. In terms of working at spaces, I've been working at Art Center since I was about 18. So it's pretty wild. So I'm 25 now. So 7 years already has been a pretty wild experience. So even during my time in college, I was on and off at a couple different centers. So to me, it feels like it's been a long time, but I have many years to keep growing and creating more experiences, hopefully.
So usually Esther asks this question, but I guess I'll jump on it. So when you were a young person, what got you doing art from very, very young age, classes that you took in elementary? And you know, how did that kind of steer you into maybe considering that as a career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I lucked out as a child, I would say, because I had a lot of people in my life that promoted art for me. Not necessarily people that were doing it professionally, but I spent a lot of time with my aunts when I was younger. And I would say they both have pretty creative backgrounds themselves. And they really were prominent in kind of letting me create all the time when they were babysitting, or if I was like staying with them for a weekend. That was always what we did to fill our time. It was creating this craft project or doing this out of the back of the magazine. It was a lot of art making. And I had very supportive parents in that way as well, that I think I would say saw that interest that I had at a young age, and they put me in classes very early on. I remember going to South Shore Arts when I was very, very young, probably like, I don't even know, 6 or 7 at that point, and taking some classes. My dad even took some classes with me, which was really fun. So I would say just having a good support system that was putting me in those programs and allowing me to maybe do what a lot of parents don't. I would say sometimes families maybe push for, you know, sports and things like that. And it's not that they didn't. I still did both. I was doing sports at the same time as well. But I definitely had family that was supportive of it and gave me the tools, I should say. Every year I was getting sketchbooks and colored pencils and things like that for Christmas. So
is that what you gravitated toward, was drawing, or was there other disciplines that really captured your imagination?
Yeah. So when I was young, I would definitely say drawing was a big one, maybe just because it was more accessible. Like it was easy for like my aunts or my parents to have a set of pastels or a set of colored pencils and a sketchbook on hand, more so than painting. Painting definitely came later. I would also say, though, that I was doing collage when I was pretty young, now that I think about it, because that was a lot of the crafts. I can think back to like the highlight magazines, and there would always be like a collage craft in the back or something three-dimensional. So I would say that drawing was definitely the dominant medium, but there was still kind of a touch on collage that maybe is where my obsession with kind of like detail really started at a young age.
I was curious, what sports did you play, just in contrast with your art?
Oh, goodness. So I have 3 older sisters who are all very talented athletes. And then I always said there was me, the like awkward lefty who tried playing sports. So I actually played softball at a very young age. I played softball for a long time. That was kind of what all my sisters and I played. And then I also did a little bit of basketball and volleyball. So I did all 3 of those. Softball was definitely probably the longest run for me. And then I finally convinced mostly my dad that I was just sick of sports and that I really wanted to focus on more arts related, just like getting more time to make art and not having to spend every day at a practice that I didn't want to go to. So yeah, I was on and off in those 3 sports though for a pretty long time, probably till I was about 13.
Yeah, sometimes that's the choice you make, as which direction in high, you know, there's so many things you can choose to do in high school, even in the arts. I mean, you know, I know my daughter did like band, choir, and theater. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that doing that was really tough, and actually taking classes in some of those. You're in high school, and drew you to making the decision to study art? And then why did you choose where you went to school?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it was kind of, I had an interesting experience, I should say, in high school. I went to Andrean, and it definitely is not a school where I would say arts is prominent. They have an arts program, but it's definitely a sports-heavy school. So I would say my previous interest in like taking art classes is definitely what continued in high school. That kind of pushed me to continue to take class after class. There was a lot of arguments with counselors over my 4 years when I would choose an art elective over maybe an additional science or math class. And there was a lot of butting heads about that and if that was a good or a bad decision, but I did it anyway, and I'm happy that I did. So it was kind of towards my senior year, I knew that I wanted to go to school for something in the arts. I wasn't dead set on studio art just yet. I don't think I had the confidence to go into college saying that that was my degree, probably mostly because the school that I was at for high school was kind of, I would say, pushing against that. So I didn't jump into it thinking studio art is what I would do. I didn't really even know about DePaul. I think I found out about them because a friend of a friend or something like that was going there. And I was like, oh, that would be great to go to a school in the city. I knew I didn't want to go to a big state school. That was just never the scene for me. I wanted to go to somewhere that was maybe a little bit more disciplined. So that's kind of how I ended up at DePaul. I knew I wanted to be far enough from home, but close enough to kind of go back and forth, because at the time I was maintaining my job at the studio, so I wanted to be able to continue to do that. But I actually started by studying cinema animation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was my original degree. I had this big mindset that I was going to basically mend my passions of like working with kids and also this idea of creating art. I told myself I could make kids movies originally. So that's kind of how I ended up in animation, even though I knew nothing about animation to be doing that. So I originally started in animation. That was my major for probably about a year and a half until I finally was like, okay, I just can't do this. Like I need to be working with people rather than behind the scenes and being stuck on the computer all the time is how I felt. I wanted to be engaging with people a lot more and actually making stuff with my hands. So I finally, I would say, got the courage by my sophomore year to make the switch into studio art.
So when you were at DePaul, I read that you, was it an internship at the Lubeznik Center? And while you were there, did you mentor under Hannah while she was education director there?
Yes. Yeah, so I was kind of doing a couple different things for them. So yes, the short answer to that is yes. I was mentored by Hannah, which was pretty amazing. So I started as a teaching artist for them. It was like one of their summer programs that was going on, actually an outreach program. So I started by just instructing for them essentially in one of their outreach programs. And then through that, I built a really great relationship with Hannah. And at that point at DePaul, we had to have an art internship. It was part of kind of like our junior year, like required class kind of a thing. It was something DePaul required specifically. So it kind of worked out perfectly where I talked with Hannah and she was totally okay with me doing the internship through her. And she needed extra help at that point anyway in their education department. So I was able to be kind of mentored by her through this semester long internship during my time at DePaul.
So what kind of things did that cover? Like,
yeah, so that was honestly, I would say the early stages of developing what then became that education coordinator position later on. So it was a lot of just assisting her really with the bigger projects that they were putting on there that she just needed really extra like bandwidth and extra time to get certain things done. So it could be something as simple as like helping organize the kids show that they promote at LCA, just even doing like the little interviews with students to kind of review their work and kind of curate pieces with them. It could be something as, you know, simple as prepping supplies for the next session of another outreach program or a class that was about to start. So it was kind of a wide range in terms of it being a class requirement for DePaul. There were some requirements that came along with that where I had to, let's say, do a certain service project. In that case, it could have been like the kids show that we did. Hannah, as my mentor, had to fill out, you know, different reviews about things that she noticed of me and different surveys and things like that. So it was partially driven by, I would say, like DePaul's requirement for it. Mm-hmm. But the biggest kind of target point was service. That was like the goal of the internship. So it was really just providing extra hands for Hannah, essentially, on any of the programs that she was currently running and all the just little things that sometimes slip through the cracks, I would say. It was really being that set of hands to kind of pick up and do all the little things that maybe she didn't need to focus on as she was focusing on the bigger picture stuff.
So I want to refer to something that you wrote, actually, because I'm not really sure what you meant by it when you were talking about being an art teacher in the classroom, but that you felt an internal absence. I'm kind of wanting you to expand on that. And also the statement that you felt that you were the biggest and sometimes only cheerleader for the arts, and you were ready to get back to an environment where others shared a similar passion. I'm wondering what made you feel that way, because as being a teacher, I know that sometimes funding for the arts isn't there, but I always felt that the schools and the students really, really loved the program, you know, that so I'm kind of wondering what your experience was to make you make that statement.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of that idea of kind of an internal absence, as I've always said, so it was kind of interesting because I would say I never had a plan to become a school teacher. I had always planned to stay in a center style space or a studio style space even. And that was always my plan going forward. People were constantly telling me to become a school teacher, including my sister, who is a school teacher. And I just always pushed against them. I was like, it's not what I want to do. I love working in a studio environment. To me, I was a teacher, but I was a studio teacher. And I think that's where that absence came from, is my intentions were to stay in a studio and actually like continue building studios in the area and kind of build up the art presence here in Northwest Indiana. And then the pandemic hit and everything changed. The center that I was working at in Lansing had to essentially close the physical space, which, you know, essentially erased my job and kind of my role at that center. So I would say it was very abrupt that I never, it sounds like so silly, but it was almost like a bad breakup. Like I had this whole passion of like building this center up and expanding it. And all of a sudden it just like everything got cut off.
So immediately and abruptly, you're right.
Yeah, it felt, it just, we had all these big plans and all of a sudden all of those just had to go to the wayside and we had to kind of scramble and, you know, we pushed along as we could until it got to the point where that wasn't really feasible anymore, essentially. So I think that's where I had to obviously make a big jump and a big change. And I kind of decided, you know, maybe this is finally the time where I need to just kind of shut people up and get myself in a school. So people that have been telling me to become a teacher, I can finally say that, you know, maybe I should try this. Maybe this is a perfect time to try it, I guess.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
So that's where, when I started in schools, it was obviously the heat of the pandemic, which was really intense. I had never taught in a school environment before, and the position that I ended up getting back at the start of last school year, I was told like a week before the year started, and I was not left with any curriculum or anything. They were just like, oh, you'll figure it out. It'll be great. And it was four different grades. So it was a lot in, you know, let's say a 7 to 10 day period of trying to scramble. So it's funny because when I say that idea of an absence, I always thought back to kind of the what if of these plans that I had made in my mind of like a studio in this area and kind of maybe even my own like reach into the community and being in a classroom. It just felt like I wasn't getting that same fulfillment of even like passion. Like I didn't feel the passion that I felt while working in a studio. And the best way I always described it to people was like, it just feels like a void. I feel like there's something that I'm missing by being in a classroom. It was enjoyable. I liked, you know, getting to teach art every day was a way better job in my mind, or kind of that backup plan, if you will, compared to getting to do a studio. It was great, but it didn't fulfill me in the way that I expected it to. I still had this like absence of like not feeling that passion that I felt and that motivation that I felt when I was in a studio space. In terms of kind of the second part that you addressed about being like the biggest cheerleader, I don't want to say I had bad experiences because I didn't have bad experiences, but I had maybe unpredictable experiences having gone from school to school to school over a year and a half time span. And each experience was so different. But at the first school I was at, I was the only art teacher in the whole building. And you're teaching, you know, four grades on top of, you know, all the factors of the pandemic, on top of, again, starting a week before the school year starts and trying to piece it together. And in that space, I really felt like I was the only one acting as that cheerleader, that advocate for the arts in the building. It wasn't that I wasn't being supported, because they were supportive, even financially, they were definitely supportive in that building. But it was tough when it comes to, you know, trying to motivate these kids to make art, and then they have the fear that they're going to get quarantined, and now they have projects sitting at the school, and what do you do with it? Or just, you know, the kids had so many things going on in their mind that I'm trying to be that class where there was almost the expectation that the art classroom was the classroom that you get to have fun and you get to forget about what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And I have to sit here and be like this positive role model for these kids. And I have to bring them up and encourage them that maybe, I think every teacher most definitely felt it in every subject.
Sure.
But art was just,
I know, you have to tell them art is an actual class.
Right. It was just so, that's kind of what I mean by being the cheerleader. It was like the classrooms that I was going in, there was just such an expectation being held on us to be like, oh, but you're the fun class and you're the class where they're going to have, you know, be happy and smiling the whole entire time. And they're not worried about their grade because everyone's going to get an A. And it was a lot of pressure. And it did feel like by the time I got to the third school that I was at, there wasn't a ton of support, I would say, for the arts. It was like there was nobody that understood it the way that I did. There was nobody that understood how we were being impacted differently than the other classrooms. Something as simple as like sharing supplies, like you couldn't do that anymore. You had to think about that and you had to, you know, separate and simplify. And it did really feel like at times, even against like some of the kids, you know, I had to be the one that was like, no, this is going to be fun. This is going to be good. You're going to enjoy this class, and really advocate for it and be this big cheerleader. And it didn't always feel like the kids or even the admin at times were the ones doing that for me. It felt like I really had to start that energy. Maybe they would support it and back me up, but I had to be the one that was like really, really kind of promoting things and, you know, again, just being like that positive face when I personally was going through this internal struggle of like, I don't even know if teaching is what I want to do altogether.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that.
Let's talk briefly about your own art practice. Tell us a little about what you like to do and where we can see some of your work. I know that that's available at a website online, but tell us about how you approach that and some of the things you create.
Absolutely. So I would say in my own studio practice, I always kind of deem myself to be like a painter, a collager, and a dabbler is always what I say. I love to paint. I typically use acrylic paints a lot in my own work, but then collage has always been a really big part of my practice. I really just enjoy kind of disassembling something and then trying to reassemble it back together. That kind of started in college, I would say. I had a great professor who had us essentially do this project where we created something, not knowing what would happen with it, and he made us destroy it in the class in front of him. And then he was like, okay, now you have to figure out how to make something else with it. And most of the kids were furious because they're like, oh my gosh, why did you just make me make this thing for weeks just to tear it apart? But for some reason, it just like, I don't know, it just inspired me. It like fueled me a little bit. So that became a really big part of my process, was kind of creating these big jumbled messes and trying to find a way to piece them back together and really focusing on just the process of kind of making things all together. So I do a lot of that. I like to work abstract and non-objective. I've always had this, again, kind of something that developed in college, this own mantra that I like to take representational conversations and experiences and maybe even people in my life, but represent them in a way that's a little bit more abstracted, to where you might look at one of my works of art and have no idea what it means. So that's kind of a big part for me, is finding interesting ways to abstract things. But yeah, in terms of where you can find me, currently, I have an art Instagram page that I try to keep as active as possible as I'm making stuff. That is Art by Jill B. And then I have been selling some work with Society 6, which is a great supporter of the arts, and they kind of turn your work into different products. So that's society6.com/JillBArtwork.
And we'll have we'll have that as a link on your picture on the website, so they can link to that, at least one of those websites. Go ahead.
Great. I have some Chesterton questions. So what are you working on now for the Art Center? Like, what direction are you going in? What's the next step for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of our big goal here at Chesterton Art Center, obviously as a program director, it's to build this idea of outreach and kind of really start expanding into the community. One of our big goals is to make our programming more accessible, especially. And a couple ways that we're doing that, one of the big ones that just happened, is we released a scholarship program where both adult and children can apply for scholarships towards our classes of all sorts, camps and things like that. So that's one of the big ways that we're actively making that happen.
So what are the details on that? I'm sure a lot of people will be interested.
Absolutely. Yeah, so all you have to do is actually go to our website at chestertonart.org. If you navigate to the classes tab, one of the options is to view the scholarship application. So it's as simple as going to the website, checking out the classes page, and you'll see the scholarship link listed right there. And you basically just fill out an application, we review it, and we kind of make our executive decision on applying that scholarship for you.
And so what are your hopes for outreach into the community? What do you specifically mean by that?
Yeah, so one of the big goals in general is to create outreach. It's something that the Chesterton Art Center has really been trying to do over the last few years, especially because it's not something they've done traditionally, I would say. So one of the ways we've already started to do that is we established a program with the Boys and Girls Club. We're actively running a 25-week program, and our hope is to essentially partner with more organizations similar to them and create similar programs that are free or at reduced cost for the community, especially for kids at this point. And then hopefully also stuff that we're going to host here at the center, family days, things like that, that are, you know, just free and accessible to the community to come in and have an excuse to actually see this space, but then also us going out into the community and bringing these art programs to other organizations as well.
Are there other organizations that you have in mind? Like, you mentioned Boys and Girls Club, but who else are you hoping to work with?
Yeah, so we're really hoping for targeting spaces that are similar to them. Right now, we're working on kind of building those partners. We don't have names necessarily just yet, or at least we're not far enough into those relationships, I would say, to kind of name them. But I would say any spaces that really focus on community and kids specifically already are going to be kind of our target goals with those.
And real quick, we have just a little less than a minute left. Are you looking for new instructors and expanding your instructor portfolio?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say we're constantly looking for new instructors and offering all different media and types of classes here. So if there's ever anybody that feels they have a talent or a skill that they want to share or a class that they would like to offer, we're always looking and interested in new instructors for both classes and workshops.
Very good. Well, you've been listening to Jillian Bridgman. She's the new program director for the Chesterton Arts Center in Porter County. And you can see what she's doing and how she has planned for the future. And you can see her own art practice if you click on the link on her page. Jillian, thank you so much for being part of Art on the Air.
Yeah, best of luck, Jillian.
Thank you. Nice meeting you guys.
You've been listening to Art on the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP Station Manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art on the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art on the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you this great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.